The first case on this morning's en banc oral argument calendar is Christie Park et al. V. Wells Fargo Bank, case number 65735. Good morning, Ms. Gilbert. Mr. Jacobs, ready to go? All right. Please proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Jacqueline Gilbert, along with Diana Klein and Jesse Panoff, representing Chris Park. Mr. Park appreciates this Court exercising its discretion and giving him an opportunity to discuss these important issues raised by the bank, despite any infirmity in the briefing. Just as he presumes, the bank will be relying on this Court's discretion to address an issue raised for the first time in respondent's answering brief and to overlook the bank's failure to comply with NREP 44. That said, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor. This Court should reverse the order dismissing the complaint for the following four reasons. First, it was based on an error of law, which the SFR decision has determined. Second, NRS 116 is constitutional, as already set forth in the SFR decision. In Nevada, price alone is not enough to avoid a sale as commercially unreasonable. And four, there simply is no taking. Addressing taking first, the bank conflates the cases and the types of taking to urge this Court to give it safe harbor from its own failure to protect its interest. A taking requires the destruction or taking of private property by the state for a public purpose. The bank fails to identify either a state actor or a public purpose. NRS 116 provides a framework in which private parties can enforce private remedies. No state or government interference is involved in the process, and a state actor is required both here and for due process, which is missing in their analyses. First, they try to rely on eminent domain, but eminent domain talks about the public purposes, things like roads, utilities, airports, etc. The creation and maintenance of a common interest community simply is not included there. Further, NRS 116.1107 expressly prohibits an HOA from exercising eminent domain. Second, on a regulatory taking, which appears to be where they're landing, the mere enactment of NRS 116.3116 constituted a taking, but they failed to analyze the factors required, the economic interest of impact of the regulation, the character of the government action, and finally, and probably most dispositive, the interference with a reasonable investment-backed expectation. The cases that they rely on, Radford, Security Industrial Bank, both involve regulatory takings which took interest that existed at the time the statutes were enacted. Here, the bank had no interest at the time the statute was enacted. It didn't have an interest until 2010. And it would have been a taking had the legislature not exempted expressly liens that existed prior to 1992, or had it not expressly exempted at that time CC&Rs that existed prior to 1992. But it did. It avoided a takings. Further, thus the bank had no reasonable expectation that it would have a lien with priority over an association lien when it loaned money in 2010 or any time after 1992 in a community created before it lent that money. Third, they try to use the Armstrong, the U.S. United States case, to conflate the regulatory taking, the enactment at the time that the interest existed, with the contractual taking by the government in that case.
Ms. Gilbert?
Yes.
I'm just curious your take as you're standing there. This is yours. Since I was reviewing the order granting the motion to dismiss in judgment, it's silent as to the legal basis. Can you give us an inclination of what the court's feelings were?
I wish I could, Your Honor. The record is silent as to what the court's inclinations were, and it appears that they just allowed respondent or the defendant below to simply write the order on all the issues raised in its motion to dismiss. We know that the legal basis as far as the reading of the statute was wrong. Now, and so they've raised the two other issues, commercial reasonableness and a facial constitutional attack here, and they raised it below, and then takings is brand new, raised for the first time on appeal. So there's nothing in the record. There was no transcript in the record. So I can't answer that. In Armstrong, the material men lost all interest when the government took possession of the property because of sovereign immunity. Here, the statute's been in effect for 30 years, and the bank has had, throughout that time and since it loaned, an ability to save itself, something the material men had no ability to do. Even a case recently decided in the U.S. District Court rejected a takings argument, one that I believe that the bank will be relying on later. This simply was a balance of the needs of two private entities, lenders and their need to be able to enforce their deeds of trust, and HOAs and their ability to provide services for the members of their association. We believe that there is no takings here, and this court should reject any argument thereof. Commercial reasonableness. The bank is asking this court, with no facts other than price, to decide as a matter of law that price alone is enough to void a sale as commercially unreasonable. That is just in direct contravention to all Nevada law. In Nevada, there must be some kind of evidence of something like fraud, oppression, or unfairness. There simply is nothing here. There's certainly nothing in the record, because this is a motion to dismiss, just like the SFRB U.S. Bank case. So long as an association follows the statute, there should be no problem. Even if it is, it doesn't necessarily result in unwinding a sale. In almost every case they cited, Golden, Levers, even in other cases, this court has not necessarily unwound the sale. It depends on the facts and whether the buyer was actually involved. Even the case they rely on out of Vermont, Will v. Mill Condominium, was not simply on price alone. They expressly said that. There were other factors involved there where the buyer was actually involved in what they called the unfairness that took place there. So this should simply reject commercial unreasonableness at this stage of the proceedings. There are no facts. They allege no facts. They simply say price should be enough. And as Judge Crowe recently said before he retired, in the Burn Valley Port Trust, the Wells Fargo case, that you have to look at commercial reasonableness at the time of the sale. In other words, the environment at the time of the sale. The time of this sale took place, we were in the midst of the litigation. And as Judge Crowe said, based on the risks that were being taken by both sides, quite honestly, to either not pay or pay, that a large discrepancy between the purchase price a buyer would be willing to pay and the assessed value of the property is to be expected. The commercial reasonableness just does not give a reason to affirm in this case. Due process. We believe that the SFR decision actually did a facial constitutional analysis. First of all, to find it was to an as-applied constitutional analysis requires that you take a facially constitutional statute and apply it to that person. A facial challenge requires that it can be found unconstitutional in no circumstance. So it should fail there. Plus, the SFR court went through the statutory scheme and each statute that was involved, and it included and recognized the inclusion and adoption of 107090, including parts 3B and 4, which require notice of default under 3B to be sent to any junior lien holder, and 4, which requires the notice of sale to be sent to anybody who's entitled under 3B.
Ms. Gilbert, that was my question. I know it's a motion to dismiss, so you didn't get very far with the quiet title action, but was there an issue as to whether or not Wells Fargo received notice of the HOA lien and the notice of sale, or did you even get that far in the court proceeding?
There's nothing in the court proceedings. The allegations were the same as in SFR, where the allegations were that they received notice. But to be clear, constitutional due process does not require receipt of notice. It requires procedures that are reasonably anticipated to provide actual notice. It's not receipt. It's does the procedure, if I mail it to the address that's on the deed of trust or the recorded documents, is it reasonably likely to get there? That's the analysis, not receipt.
But if they received it, at least.
If we received it, we're there.
I'm just saying, did you get that far?
We didn't get that far, Your Honor. And they're doing a facial challenge, which they claim does not require the facts anyway. It's whether the statute is reasonably designed to give them notice. So that's where we're at in this. And this court has already decided it. It mentioned 107090 no less than four times. On page 410, 411, where it incorporated 3B and 4, on page 417, 418, and the dissent in 422. Recognize that. This is simply not an opt-in statute. The new statutes don't in any way, shape, or form change that. To the extent that they would say the statute was ambiguous, the constitutional avoidance doctrine requires this court to read the statute as it existed as constitutional. It should not even go there. It's already been there.
Was there any commentary from the court? This is a 12B5 as to the sufficiency of the complaint or lack thereof. Or did we morph into summary judgment? What explanation, please?
The argument below was that this should have been summary judgment based on the amount of attachments that went with the motion to dismiss. The court in the order said it wasn't going there. The reply brief to the motion to dismiss stated that it shouldn't be morphed into it, that it was simply void on its face, and then it incorporated all the arguments. So that's all we have to work on the order. It simply says that It doesn't extinguish and for other reasons.
So procedurally, there's nothing that distinguishes this case from the SFR decision?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
It comes up on a motion to dismiss.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, Ms. Gilbert, so I assume this order from Judge Barker predated SFR. So you're saying even under SFR, it has to go back for an SFR analysis at a minimum.
I believe that this can go back with this court rejecting takings, rejecting a facial constitutional attack. And
well, why should we reach takings? It wasn't raised in the district court.
I don't believe you should, Your Honor, but for prudence.
But I understand.
I had to argue it, but I don't believe you should, Your Honor. But to the extent, and quite honestly, to the extent that this court can reach those issues to stop the extensive litigation that is going on below and give guidance to the district courts that this statute is constitutional, it was constitutional, you know, before the change in the legislature this year, and it remains constitutional to this day, that there is no takings, that these are private parties. To the extent this court can send that kind of instruction back to the district court, we would ask that it can do that rather than wait. And the policy arguments have been rejected. The legislature is deemed that's in the purview of the legislature. This court has already determined that and shouldn't go further. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time unless there's more questions.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Gilbert.
Thank you.
Mr. Jacobs. Good morning, Your Honors. Andrew Jacobs, Kelly Dove, and Rick Gordon for Wells Fargo. This case is crucially different from SFR and one of the points of fact that was just discussed with the court. In SFR, there were seven votes together that notice mattered. The majority said that it's a pleading stage case and proper notice was pleaded, notice was given, and the dissenters were concerned that there's a constitutional element to giving notice. So all seven of you agreed that notice really mattered. And I respectfully differ with counsel that this is a case where notice appears on the face of the pleadings. There was an allegation on information and belief that notice was received. They say it doesn't matter, but that's how they pleaded it, that it was received. But then they took that back in their briefing, which is really important in a Rule 12 motion. They took it back.
Counsel, we're looking at 12B5, yes. Face of the pleadings.
Yes, Your Honor.
This did not morph, as I understand, unless you're going to tell me differently, into a summary judgment where other things were brought in. So on its face, right, is what the court was supposed to look at. So how did we get there when I have a vague order that doesn't tell me except based upon all pleadings arguments made? It doesn't pinpoint any particular thing, and I gather this was prepared by counsel, so
it was prepared by counsel, right. It was prepared by counsel, Justice Douglas. It was approved by all counsel, and it seems to rely on generally the grounds advanced by Wells Fargo. But the place where you
well,
get...
But what grounds? Was a specific grounds? Or everything was true, and unlike 12b-5, where was the court is supposed to accept the pleadings as being true and correct, unless otherwise shown.
The court...
I have a problem. I don't understand. The order doesn't tell me. There's no footprints. There's no tea leaves. There's nothing.
Absolutely, Justice. And sometimes, you know, orders are unsatisfying, and they just say so ordered, and then the law presumes that the grounds that were necessary to reach the decision were, in fact, part of the order, which I would say here is either commercial unreasonableness or a due process issue. I think
but
that's what is entailed by the order.
Commercial unreasonableness would begin to take other facts outside of the pleadings. So I kind of take that one off the table. What was your other issue?
Well, then that would seem to take us back, Justice Douglas. Under that logic, then it seems to be a holding that the statute is unconstitutional under the Due Process Clause, because that was argued by
Wells Fargo. Nothing is articulated that the statute is unconstitutional. That would seem very easy to write in the order.
Well,
but the court did that. So there's a question of did the court exercise its discretion by not giving us why? Especially with 12b-5 and the rigorous standard for application there.
I don't think the law can presume that none of the bases advanced by Wells Fargo was the basis, Justice Douglas. Clearly it was one or more of them, and I believe it was the due process rationale. But an important distinction...
Are you suggesting that while we can't assume none of them were what the court considered, we can consider some of them were what the court considered? That's what you just said.
The law presumes, as a general rule, that whatever grounds are necessary to sustain the decision.
I understand that. You just eliminated one of those grounds. So
I was responding to the premise in Justice Douglas's question. He said basically you would have had to have gone outside the papers to do one of them. So I said therefore it must be the others, Justice Sata. That's all I'm trying to say. That's all
so
I'm
we're just
that.
Supposed to imply from the findings or lack thereof that that's what it was.
If you exclude one, then the law presumes the remaining reasons is all I meant to indicate, Justice. That's all I'm saying.
I want to go back to something you said a moment ago, which has to do with the notice allegation. You said it was on information and belief that this was alleged, and that's true as to paragraph 16. But you get into the body of the first claim for relief, and you have a number of more specific allegations, including not on information and belief, just an unvarnished one. Defendants received adequate and proper notice that the assessment lien default election to sell and notice of sale.
Yes,
we have that allegation, and we have a 12b-5 motion to dismiss, and we have an order. Unlike SFR, where I think it was Judge Tao had that case, and he wrote a long order explaining why he ruled as he did, or if it wasn't Judge Tao, whoever it was, we had an order that articulated the basis. Here, I have to credit that allegation in paragraph 35 for purposes of evaluating the motion to dismiss. Whether it's true or not down the road, you may be able to prove something different. But are you saying they also withdrew that allegation in the context of the motion practice on this?
Essentially, Justice Pickering.
Essentially, or did they?
I would say yes, Justice Pickering. If I could explain the way in which they did it, that might clarify the issue
somewhat.
And, Justice, what they did was they said that the notice that was received at page 4 of their motion to dismiss was the constructive notice. The notice that was given was the constructive notice of the recordation. So they seemed to be standing on the recordation of notice that they were going to conduct the sale as opposed to giving the mailed notice. And also they plead 62 through 68. They never plead 107.090. They plead all the other relevant subparts. They
when you
don't
say plead,
090.
You mean argue? In their motion?
No, plead, I mean the complaint. They mentioned 62 through 68 and not .090, Justice Pickering. And then in the motion practice, what they say is, Park has no knowledge of whether prior lien holders received notice. Now, how could you say that if you mailed the notice? How could you really say that? And then they also say it was constructive notice at page 4. That's the notice they affirmatively state.
So they argued constructive notice, and from that you infer that they're conceding their withdrawing allegation in paragraph 35 of their complaint?
No, I would say they never alleged compliance with 107.090. They alleged 62 through 68, which, as SFR indicates, is an opt-in provision. And under the language of this court's decision in SFR, page 411, the court is saying...
But they alleged defendants received adequate and proper notice. I mean, this is the 12B5 stage.
Well, sure, Justice Pickering, but then they say in their brief, you just said that they received proper notice, but then in their brief they say...
I didn't say that they did. I said that's what they alleged.
Right, exactly. No, you're exactly right. That's what the pleading says. And then the brief says exactly the opposite. Park has no knowledge of whether they received notice. The allegation that you said is that notice was received. The allegation back in their clarification is no knowledge of whether they received notice.
Well, wouldn't they have discovery on what was actually received down the road? I mean, I don't know who had notice or what. I know they alleged that there was notice.
But as you justices have been pointing out, we're here on a 12B5. The allegation matters, and if someone wants to walk back their complaint and say, I really have no idea whether notice was received after pleading the opposite, then the prior inconsistent allegation falls away under the law. That's what we're saying here.
You're confusing allegations with brief writing, motion practice. And at the 12B5 stage, the district judge is compelled to take that which is set forth in the complaint as true. That's where the decision comes from. Would you agree with me?
Subject to the caveat that you can always say something in your brief that recants an allegation, as happened here, Justice Sata.
As a pleading, okay.
Yes, you can recant an allegation of your pleading. The one Justice Pickering just mentioned was specifically recanted. It was, they got notice, and it was at page 20, no, they didn't get notice. That's a very specific recantation of an allegation.
Where's your site on where they did the recantation in the record?
It's the one just mentioned was page 20, colon, line 11, and stating that it was constructive notice, which is the notice they allege, is at page 4, line 11. So those are the two references I've mentioned, Justice Pickering.
And just to be clear, I'm kind of biting you hard. I want to hear... The constructive notice mentioned in their brief, you say, is equivalent to recanting?
No.
No, okay. The other one you say is equivalent to recanting. What does that say?
It says, quote, Park has no knowledge of whether prior lien holders received notice, which I believe directly contradicts the allegation, Justice, you raised in your immediately prior question. And that is consistent.
Would you agree, though, that that statement in a brief could be interpreted to say, we're not sure whether the mail arrived or, in other words, that we gave the legally required notice, but this guy may not have received it. He may have been out of town. There may have been a flood. I mean, I don't know.
I don't think so, Justice, because when you allege A and then in your brief you say not A, I think you have to credit the later specific statement. I think the law lets that happen, and that should be the right
answer. Well, I think you could say, I withdraw that because he didn't get notice. That would be easy. But you're trying to... read a lot into, you're freighting what was said in them.
Or we proceed with a better record below, i.e. moving out of the motion to dismiss stage.
Yeah. And they were the ones who invoked the power of the state to take property from someone. They have a quiet title action. They have to plead that element. I don't need to affirmatively disprove it. They have to plead it. And so in their motion practice, they take away an element they need affirmatively to plead and to prove, then they have negated the fundamental element of the quiet title action, and that's our argument. Basically, you know, this case is Mennonite. I heard counsel say that the bank didn't do enough to take care of itself. The Mennonite dissent, to me, really disposes of the idea that with respect to property rights, we live in a regime where anyone, whether it's a bank or a person, is sort of on guard and caveat emptor and go rummage through the public records and look for sales and protect yourself. In fact, the Mennonite dissent specifically lamented that that was not going to be the rule, that the Supreme Court had adopted a per se rule with respect to the taking of property rights that Nevada and American legal culture prizes very highly. And it was in Mennonite, it wasn't that the sheriff's sale was struck down as unconstitutional. The statute, the mechanism itself was struck down as unconstitutional in Mennonite. And it was clearly state action. State action is present here, and that's one of the things, though they have no reply brief here, and the arguments respectfully that counsel advanced before were all waived by non-assertion. Notwithstanding that, it's clearly state action here to get to the nub of that. This court's decision in Beasley versus Davis from 1976 makes clear that state actions include not only the acts of a legislature, but also the acts of the state's judicial officers. And so legislative acts matter. It's not called the executive branch action doctrine. It's the state action doctrine. And the state consists of all these different and equally important parts of the government. So there was state action in Mennonite. The law was struck in Mennonite because somebody didn't know that their property rights were going to be taken away. And that's why it's so crucial here, when you look at this case, to understand how flip and blasé it is to say in your reply brief, when you invoke the coercive power of the state to take a property away from somebody, you're going to seriously say, I have no idea whether they got notice. That shouldn't be the law. It's not fair, it's not right, and it's not consistent with the fundamentals of American property rights in Mennonite and its progeny.
Counsel, is the bank in general, I've listened to what you've been saying, is the bank pleading generally across the board ignorance as to the statute, the 116 section? Just out of curiosity, based on what you've been saying.
No, Your Honor, we don't plead ignorance as to the statute, but the statute,
so,
yes.
Just, I've been listening and you've been taking the legislature to task for trying to deal with the problem and putting it out as to the inaction by the bank in terms of their responsibility in this corporate society, in this civil society, to take care of their own property. Coming back fundamentally to what's before us this day, and I appreciate your argument, but nonetheless, we're back into basic civil procedure. First year law school, motion to dismiss on its pleadings, accepting what's in there as true unless otherwise shown differently. And that's why the question was, is this a pure 12B5 on the face of the pleadings, or did we get into summary judgment that I'm not made aware of? Simple question, simple answer. Summary judgment or 12B5?
It's 12B5, Your Honor, with judicial
then
notice.
Then did we go outside of the pleadings to get the position you're taking on behalf of your client?
No, because judicial notice doesn't convert the motion into a Rule 56 motion in this case. It does not, Your Honor. As far as the bank taking care of itself, you know, the rule of law needs to be there not only for banks but for all actors, commercial and otherwise, and the law cares equally about what all of them do. And this statute in this case acted in a way where property rights were taken away without the knowledge of the bank. And all of the questions that are...
How do we know from this record? You and I engaged on this a moment ago, so I don't need pages 4 and 20, lines 11. But from your side of this, where does it establish affirmatively that your client had no knowledge and no notice?
We didn't establish that because it's their pleading for quiet title. We established
okay.
that they didn't plead the element,
okay.
and thus their
Understood.
Case was dismissed.
Understood.
We didn't have a burden. We didn't go outside the evidence to affirmatively prove lack of knowledge.
We're assuming that that's why it was dismissed at this point, since the order that was prepared is silent as to legal reasoning.
The legislature's action this year is very important, and I believe this court, I would argue that this court should keep in mind the unanimous enactment by the legislature of a regime which adopted the signal characteristic of the SFR dissent, which is that you can't extinguish property rights without notice or an opportunity to redeem. That's fully consistent with Mennonite. That's consistent with how these statutes work in the other American states. The fact that the legislature, whose law that you were solemnly interpreting today, that same legislature enacted unanimously Senate Bill 306 means something. And what it seems to mean is that the legislature doesn't want deprivations of rights to property without notice and without rights of redemption, as the dissent argued, and that would bring Nevada completely consistent with the due process traditions that adhere with property rights, not only in federal law, but in the other states which, under the UCIOA, have that Section 116J that you wrote about in SFR, Justice Pickering. So the amendment by the legislature matters very deeply.
It's not retroactive, but you would ask us to treat it as clarifying and significant in that regard.
Well, they argue legislative intent, Justice Pickering, and I think it shows their intent with respect to the statutory scheme. It sends a very clear signal that this statutory scheme is not meant to be confiscatory without notice, and that would make Nevada accord with Mennonite, the Federal Due Process Clause, and basically every other jurisdiction that has a uniform act like this. And with that, my time has expired.
Counsel, would you be opposed to this going back so the issue of notice could be vetted properly?
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with counsel that the state needs guidance on this. And this statute either is unconstitutional because it violates Mennonite by giving no notice and taking people's stuff from them, or it isn't. That's a question that's been fully teed up to this court, and I believe all sides would request that this court resolve it. It's an important issue. There are hundreds of millions of dollars of property in limbo because of the lack of resolution of that question, and we respectfully implore you to resolve that question, Your Honors. Thank you for your time.
Your Honor, I don't believe the issue of notice needs to go back. Quite honestly, the buyer who does not, at a sale, who goes to a foreclosure sale, whether it's 107 or 116, has nothing to do with the noticing. Nothing. They are allowed to rely on the conclusive recitals that were present in the trustee's deed that the bank asked the court to take judicial notice of that states the default occurred as set forth in the notice of default. It complied with all requirements of law, including the mailing of notice of delinquent assessments, which isn't required, to anybody other than the homeowner. The notice of default, the elapsing of the 90 days, and the giving of the notice of the notice of sale.
What do you say to your opposing colleague that you walked back the allegation of affirmative notice in your complaint? Do you agree with him?
No, Your Honor. I think that the statement that Mr. Part makes, which is, we have no actual notice, we would have no actual notice. It's not up to the buyer at a sale, at a foreclosure sale, to go and find out if the notice was done. It can rely on the trustee's deeds. And when
my question was different. Did you withdraw the allegation in paragraph 35 of your complaint that there was adequate and reasonable notice?
No, I don't believe so. While it talks about constructive notice, it also talks that all of the requirements of 3116 to 31168 are included. And 31168 incorporates by reference the whole of 107090. Didn't have to be stated in the pleadings. 116 incorporates it by reference. There's no reason to go there. I went there because they keep trying to avoid the fact that two parts of it exist that were recognized, and they want to ignore it, and they want this court to ignore it. What they also haven't done is what they're saying is, when an HOA, when a foreclosure takes place, the extinguishment of junior liens happens as a matter of law. That somebody has to come in and stop a junior lien holder from taking over its property. May I finish, Your Honor? Just this one statement?
Mm-hmm.
To stop a junior lien holder from trying to exercise rights it no longer has does not transform that action into state action through the court. Mennonite was decided before Flagg Brothers. Flagg Brothers expressly says there is no state action for a private remedy. We would ask this court to decide those issues and reverse and remand so that Mr. Park can get quiet title. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.